from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, some doctors say there are more organs available for donation, and that could be another consequence of the opioid epidemic. Also, new internet-connected toys might be cute.
My favorite color is red.
Okay, I'll try to remember. You are the best kid I have ever met.
But they are raising concerns about children's privacy. Plus, author Jennifer Traynor Thompson's latest cookbook on fresh fish, focusing on the New England coast.
Sort of an ode to barefoot living and, you know, scrunching with sand between your toes, hanging out in the salt marshes, and just to create the feel of the coast.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. An apparent, unexpected consequence of the nation's opioid epidemic is that more organs are available for transplant. The New England Organ Bank says in 2011, about 8% of heart transplants involved donors who died of drug overdoses. So far this year, more than 30% of the transplants involve hearts from someone who overdosed. That's contributed to a record-breaking number of heart transplants at Tufts Medical Center. Last Friday, Tufts doctors performed the hospital's 38th heart transplant this year. The previous record was 37 transplants in a single year. To talk more about this, we're joined by Dr. David D'Onofrio. He's director of the Advanced Heart Failure Program at Tufts Medical Center. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So last year, Tufts performed 19 transplants overall. Why so many more this year and the year's not even over?
Well, you know, it's really incredible. We're very, very excited to see the number of transplants that we've done this year and how many lives have been saved by organ donation. I think it's multifactorial in terms of why we've been so successful. I think we've spent a lot of time over the last 10 years, and it's been a real priority for Tufts Medical Center to invest in the resources necessary to build a world-class heart transplant program. We really work with partners throughout New England to share care and to co-manage patients, which has been very important for us to be able to develop a large referral base and a large number of patients that are on our list. Just an example, if you look at the entire regional list in New England, we have 50% of the list are patients at Tufts Medical Center that are waiting for heart transplants. The other piece of the equation are, you know, is we've had real renewed energy from the surgical side, and we've been able to recruit Dr. Greg Cooper from the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's got the most experience of any surgeon in the region in terms of heart transplant and has brought a wealth of experience and talent to our program, and I think compared to other programs is willing to make some of these donors work that I think other programs may be hesitant to take.
And what's leading to the increased availability of hearts available for transplant?
And that's the third piece of the equation, you know, increased donors. So there's, you know, clearly been an increase in donor availability in the region this year. We think that the New England Organ Bank has played a big part of that in terms of the work where they've increased donor awareness, increased, you know, working with hospitals to find donors. But, you know, clearly in the background has been the opioid crisis, and we're seeing more donors that have become available that died due to drug intoxication.
Are there increased risks from a heart donated from someone who died of an overdose, or is there any kind of special testing involved? Anything different there?
Yeah. So, you know, you know, there's clearly criteria to look at the risk for disease transmission from donors. The CDC had a risk profile, but now it's called the Physicians Health System Increased Risk Criteria. And, you know, one of the criteria to be an increased risk for disease transmission donor is IV drug use. And clearly, you know, a large percentage of our donors that die from drug intoxication do have a history of IV drug use. And because of that, you know, there's an increased risk of certain diseases. The three main diseases that we get concerned about and that have been tracked are hepatitis C, hepatitis B, and HIV. So, you know, clearly, you know, those need to be looked at, and those donors need to be screened for those diseases prior to transplant.
And you can tell immediately before the transplant whether or not those diseases might become a risk for the recipient.
You know, and again, it's something that's evolved. We, you know, all the donors that have these increased risk criteria get tested, and we've got some sensitive tests available now to actually detect the RNA and the DNA of these viruses in the blood of the donor. Unfortunately, it's not 100%, so that even though the what we call NAT testing or nucleic acid testing is negative for these viruses, there's still a very small chance that the recipient can contract the disease, so that we're really mandated by CMS and UNOS, in you know, the federal government, basically to inform our recipients that we are going to use a donor that potentially has this increased risk. We've done our due diligence to try to make sure that the risk is the least that it can be by doing this special testing, but the recipient has to sign an informed consent form and be willing to say, I know that there's a low risk, but it's real, but I know that I'm going to die potentially of a, you know, of heart failure, and that I'm willing to take that risk, and then we'll proceed with the transplant.
When a heart becomes available, it's my understanding that it's a very short window that you have before you can actually use it in someone else. Is that true?
Yes. You know, when an organ gets procured and taken out of the donor's body and put on ice, and, you know, and then has to be transplanted, we usually want that total out-of-body, you know, ischemic time to be around 4 hours at the most. And when you get up above 4 hours, there's a concern that the heart may not work as well.
You know, the Boston Globe did a story earlier this summer about 4 heart transplants being done in one day at Tufts. So if you have increased availability and obviously there's demand, do you think that our medical community, not just at Tufts, but here in New England, has the resources to keep up with the demand?
I think it's clearly important for us to make sure that those resources are available. We have, you know, over 4,000 people in the United States waiting for hearts that are dying from advanced heart failure. We know that the survival rate at 1 year for these patients that are waiting is less than 50%. We know that with a heart transplant, 90% 1 year survival, better than 75-80% 5 year survival, and 50-60% 10 year survival. So you stretch that mortality of 50% at 1 year to now a survival rate of 50% at 10 years. That we really owe it to the community to make sure that we have the resources available to transplant, you know, patients that are waiting with these donors that become available due to an increased supply. And at Tufts Medical Center, we really have invested in the resources to make sure that we can do these things. It's unbelievable to me. I've been in the business 20 years, and I never had a year where we did 4 hearts in one day. And we also had 2 days where we did 2 simultaneous transplants, 2 heart transplants ongoing at the same time. So it's really an exciting time for us, and I think really happy that we can have patients do so well. It's not just the volume, it's the outcomes and patients really doing well with their new hearts and really getting a new lease on life.
All right, Dr. David D'Onofrio, Director of the Advanced Heart Failure Program at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
For information about how to register as an organ donor, go to our website, radioboston.org. Massachusetts Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas is swapping her congressional district for one in Ohio, at least temporarily. Tsongas and Republican Ohio Congressman Mike Turner are spending time in each other's districts to talk about common projects, particularly next month's deadline for Congress to reach a budget deal. The two visited Ohio yesterday, touring Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and General Electric Aviation. Today, they toured Massachusetts, visiting Raytheon, Vibram, a shoe sole company, and MIT. Both are members of the Armed Services Committee, and they join us now to talk about their so-called district swap and what they learned today. Congressman Tsongas, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deb. Great to be with you, and great to be back in Massachusetts.
Well, Congressman Turner, welcome to you as well.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I appreciate the invitation from the Congress.
I'm just wondering, Congressman Tsongas, let's start with you. This is the second time that you've done a district swap. Why do you think it's important to do this?
Well, I think we learn so much as we visit each other's districts, and in particular, given our joint service on the Armed Services Committee, that each of us represent our district on that committee, there's much to learn.
Congressman Turner, what stands out most about your visits to Massachusetts today?
We're really very integrated. I mean, what's exciting, I think, is when Congresswoman Tsongas was walking through Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and GE, repeatedly, the references were made to the connections right here in Massachusetts. Similarly, as I'm here touring, even at MIT where we're standing here right now, a lot of the research and development that's occurring here is funded through Air Force Research Labs, which are based in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in my district. So that integration, that commonality, I think, is really important.
What are some of the common things, Congressman Tsongas, that you heard during your visits today to Raytheon, Vibram, and MIT?
Well, first, I would say the critically important role federally funded research plays, and in particular that which comes through the Defense Department. We really do confront very innovative adversaries and who are constantly testing the limits of our technologies, and so we have to remain very adept. I think the other real issue and something we'll face as we go back to Washington is that we find a way to deal with the issues of sequestration. We had a 3-year budget agreement that essentially did that, but it looms again, and we've got to find a way to resolve it.
Right. So we did, as we mentioned, you're both on the Armed Services Committee. So and the deadline is the end of next month for Congress to reach a budget deal or face a possible continuing resolution so as not to have a partial government shutdown. Congressman Turner, I'm told that reports from your visit yesterday, the two of you visiting Ohio yesterday, that you said that there is not enough support in Congress for a continuing resolution unless there is more money for the military. Is that right?
Well, what they can't do is underfund. I mean, the House representative has already passed legislation for the National Defense Authorization Act and the appropriation bills that all set the mark of the funding level at the amount that was requested by the White House. And what we can't do is fund our Department of Defense at a number less than that.
And so the White House, it's my understanding, has threatened to veto the defense bill because of some concerns, including the plan to shut down the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and not doing that on President Obama's timetable. Is that right?
Well, most of the issues that the president has called attention to in the NDA as non-starters, areas of which he would veto, are actually bipartisan provisions. I mean, the president has faced bipartisan opposition to his plans for Guantanamo. These are issues where that obviously are going to have to be resolved. But the thing that we cannot do is put ourselves in a situation where those disputes get resolved in the backs of our men and women in uniform.
Mm. Is a continuing resolution, though, better than a partial government shutdown?
Well, no one ever wants a government shutdown. But again, it's going to depend on the administration. We have all the same number. So the president just has to come forward. Right now, the president has no proposal on the table with Congress at all. When we pass our bill, which we've done months ago, that's the beginning of negotiations. If the president doesn't put on the table a counterproposal, there's no negotiations happening. No one in Congress wants a partial or any shutdown whatsoever, but the president needs to get behind his desk and he needs to send a proposal to the United States Congress to begin the negotiations.
Congressman Tsongas, I'm wondering, what do you think is an increase that would be reasonable in terms of defense spending this year, as opposed to keeping it at the previous fiscal year's level, which is what a continuing resolution would do?
Well, first, just to address the issue of a continuing resolution, it certainly is preferable to, as you said, a partial shutdown of government. But there are overriding issues that we have to confront, and I very much appreciate and support the president's opposition to keeping Guantanamo open. But I think we have to put that aside for the moment, because I think the bigger issue is sequestration does great harm. But also what does great harm is sort of the halting nature by which government is funded, in particular the Defense Department.
We've had those arguments over and over again.
And we came to a three-year agreement that got us through 3 years. And now as we confront the next 2 years, we have to resolve what is the best way forward.
There is a tremendous amount of bipartisan work that happens in Congress. And we're two people that sit down every day and do bipartisan work. And I appreciate her invitation here. The items in which that divide us, it shouldn't result in the entire system coming to a screeching halt. Let's get the work done that we agree on. Let's move forward. And that's certainly what our trip has been about here today. And I greatly appreciate an invitation, and I appreciate talking to you.
Now, I just want to bring up one other thing. Last year, the last time that you did this, you had visited the New Balance factory in Lawrence, and New Balance vied for a contract to create athletic shoes for the military. Now, what came out after that was that Defense Secretary Carter criticized the requirement to provide American-made shoes to the military, saying that it gives preferential treatment to one company, and it's an example of micromanagement in the National Defense Authorization Act. Congressman Tsongas, what's your response to that?
Well, the Berry Amendment's been in place since 1941. It was put in place in World War II because the feeling was that as those going off to defend our country should be, to the best extent possible, wearing American-made shoes. That Berry Amendment applies to virtually every other article of clothing that our soldiers currently wear, but an exception was created a number of years ago because there really was no American-made training shoe. At that point, most if not all of it had been offshore. That is no longer the case. In Massachusetts, we have one company who is willing, once the Defense Department agrees to this, to move ahead and produce an all-American-made shoe. There are other companies, we heard of at least three today, that also are willing to pursue those contracts. They would have to compete in order to provide those shoes. And this has broad bipartisan support.
Okay. So sum it up, each of you, your trips to each other's districts, if you could briefly, because we're just about out of time. What would you say? Congressman Turner.
Congressman Turner has had to leave for catch an airplane. But I would say we both see how invaluable it is. Both to meet constituents from both districts, to see the great companies we have, to see the remarkable work being done to best protect this country as well as protect those seeking to serve our country.
Okay. Congressman Nikki Tsongas represents the 3rd District of Massachusetts. We also spoke with Ohio Congressman Mike Turner. Congressman Tsongas, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, new concerns about children's toys connected to the Internet. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. This fall, Mattel is set to release the 21st century version of Barbie's Dream House, which is a fully connected smart home. The lights and appliances will activate automatically when Barbie is in different rooms. A child can tell the elevator to lower, can request breakfast to start in the kitchen, or can turn on the tunes. So what sounds like a dream for digitally savvy kids is a regulatory nightmare for privacy experts. The Dream House uses the same technology behind Hello Barbie, which was released last year. That toy was criticized for being able to potentially record children who talk to the doll. The rise of connected toys is raising questions about privacy. Toymaker VTech admitted last year that cyber criminals had accessed the personal information of 6.4 million children. So, should we be worried? Well, we want to hear from you. Do you think the risks of connected toys are overestimated? Do you buy these kinds of toys, or will you? And if you do, do you take precautions? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. And joining us in studio to talk about this is Todd Beardsley. He's Senior Security Research Manager at Rapid7. Welcome.
Hi there.
Also, Josh Gollin is Executive Director of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Todd, let's start with you. Are these connected toys a significant threat, would you say?
That's a fine question. I don't know how much you would say is a significant threat, but it's certainly new, right? You know, that we've never before put this kind of technology in the hands of kids. There's a lot of concern around how they're built, and more importantly, like how they're fixed after the fact. We've looked at toys like the Mattel Hello Barbie. We looked at Fisher-Price's offering the Smart Bear, and I am happy to say that when we worked with Fisher-Price, like, they were very on the ball when it came to fixing it. Like, it's okay to make these mistakes. In security, that's kind of how we think of software. Like, software is always very incremental. And once you find a vulnerability and report the vulnerability to the vendor, if the vendor comes back with a fix, great, you know. And so we kind of keep that cadence kind of going there. But once... If vendors are unable to fix them or unwilling to fix them or unwilling to talk to researchers like me, then you kind of have a problem.
Then they're not good.
You have a little bit of a problem there. But as far as like these devices, like we're looking at an explosion of IoT like in general and kids IoT in particular, just kind of coming down the pike. And we're kind of staring at this IoT tsunami coming into our houses, into where we work, into our cars, into our medical devices. It's basically everywhere.
So what kind of information could be collected? What are we talking about here? We're talking about a three-year-old playing with a dinosaur, right? I mean,
right.
Is it, that's what many people would say. What kind of information are they really going to get?
So, it depends on how the toy is designed, but typically what we look for are things like personally identifying information, like the child's name, child's birthday, child's gender, child's physical location, kind of trivia about the kid, because not so much that it's like your kid's name is not secret, at least mine aren't, but it is often the answer to or the root of a secret password or a secret question to get at a password. Mm-hmm. And so if attackers have access to a broad population of these devices that are collecting data, not safeguarding it in the right way, now they have pretty good guesses on not only like the kid's identity, but the parents' identities. And so like getting at parents' passwords and accounts just based on what they can learn about the kid through this kind of new and unique vector of information.
Hmm. Josh Gollin, and I'm sorry for mispronouncing your last name when we first started. Josh
no problem.
Gollin, what would you say about the threat of these toys, and what are we seeing in terms of them coming on the market?
Well, what we're seeing is an explosion in the development of these toys. And I think one of the first things that it's important to recognize is that the development of these toys is driven by the toy industry is worried. They're concerned about losing kids to YouTube, to video games, to apps, to iPads and smartphones. And so they're looking for a way to make the toys look more like those things. And there's a rush to get these things into market. And it's happening without a careful consideration of the privacy issues, of the threats to children's creativity, of really of children's well-being. And so I think that, one of the things that we need to do is take a step back and say, is this really in best children's best interest to rush all of these things into the market before we've answered kind of the ethical and regulatory questions?
Well, you said threat to creativity, and I imagine here, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment. If I was a manufacturer of one of these toys, I might say to you, where's the evidence that there's any threat to creativity? And is it time for us to modernize toys as we've done with other things and use technology in what perhaps might be a positive way that could actually help kids learn how to become more tech savvy at an earlier age?
Well, I think...
I'm assuming what they would say.
Okay. and they do say that.
I'm sure.
But I think, one of the things that's really important when we think about toys, there's a saying that child development experts say that the best toys are 90% child and 10% toy. And what we're seeing is more and more being automated and driven by the toy and less by children's imagination. And of course, it's important for kids to grow up and to be tech savvy, but it's also incredibly important that we give them the time and space to exercise their creativity and their imaginations. Take Hello Barbie, for instance. So a child playing with a traditional doll is making up a conversation with that doll. They're playing both parts. That doll is anything that they want it to be. They can be brother and sister. They can be best friends. They can be, any kind of relationship they can imagine in any kind of scenario. When you play with Hello Barbie, Hello Barbie asks you a series of pointed questions that, do you have a dog? Do you have a sister? And it's very driven by the toy. It's very driven by the script that Hello Barbie has. And so all that creativity about playing and making the doll into something else or whatever the child wants to be is lost. And I think that that's a tremendous loss for children and childhood. And the more we make toys look like apps and video games, I think we're losing what the essence of a toy is. And that's about helping children creatively play.
But is there something to be said about also helping children to learn how to navigate a very sophisticated world of technology, which I feel in my age, I'm certainly handicapped compared to my own children, right? Because they grew up with it. So they learn skills that I don't have. Isn't there something to be said about teaching children those
skills? Well, there's no evidence actually that that introducing children to at a very young age to technology gives them any kind of advantage with the technology later on in life. In fact, all this technology is incredibly easy to use. That's one of the things that's, that's why babies can use iPads, because it's, they're so easy to use.
But I can't.
I think when we are talking about younger children, limiting their exposure to technology and giving them the time and space to offline time and space to be creative, to play with friends, to manipulate real objects in the real world, I think is incredibly important. And I think this rush to make our toys look like apps is something that's really undermining children's development.
So both of you have spoken about this sort of rush on the part of toy makers to do this. And I want to talk about regulations, but I also want to remind our listeners that they can join in the conversation as well. Listeners, we do want to hear from you. What do you think about the risks involved in connected toys? Do you buy these toys? Do you take precautions? Call us with your thoughts and comments, suggestions at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Todd, I'm wondering, are there potential regulations in place right now to deal with internet-connected toys at all?
I know that the FTC is certainly looking at it. We've talked to people at the FTC. We've talked to people at like state and local government levels that have expressed an interest when we published our research on toy-based security. But as far as regulation goes, it's about as regulated as the rest of the internet in that it's not very well regulated, which is fine when you're talking about things like innovation and very quick to rapid to market strategies, which is kind of how we know how to build software today. The kind of software that gets published today is often very buggy. It's minimally useful. It's the minimal viable product. And that's kind of the model that we've adopted over the last 15 or 20 years now that we have the internet. I don't know if you remember, but it used to have to get CDs in the mail to update your software. And so at that time, software, it was a big deal to ship a bug. You couldn't ship a bug. People get fired over shipping bugs. Now it's very common to ship bugs. But unfortunately, some of those bugs are also security vulnerabilities. The way that we handle it today is very much market driven. I can't call the internet cops and say hey, these guys are shipping vulnerable software and you have to stop them. We don't have much in the way of software liability. We don't have really anything in the way of software liability, except for in some very specific circumstances around like cars and medical devices. But even those lines get blurred when you start talking about IoT, the Internet of Things, and how those things talk on the Internet.
I'm wondering, what can parents do to sort of protect them? I mean, is encryption enough? Or what can folks do if they say they want the toy? Okay, they say, I think this toy may have potential benefits on some level. And they get the toy. But how do they protect information? Is there even a way?
So the first thing I usually suggest people to do is look at the box that the toy comes in. If there's an FCC warning about generating radio interference or ability to accept radio interference, which you have to do in the U.S., then you know that this thing talks on some kind of radio, and that would be either not like the radio we're talking on right now, but something along the way of like Wi-Fi or maybe short distance radio, something like Bluetooth. If you know that, then you know then there it's at least talking to something else, like it's designed to do that. And now you can kind of gauge like how useful this toy is when it's talking on when it's interacting with something else versus on its own, right? Like Hello Barbie looks just like a Barbie and is probably pretty useful as a normal Barbie, even if you never powered it on. And so maybe that would be like, it's a kind of an awful mitigation. You know, it's not the kind of mitigation that Mattel probably would suggest. But if there's a capability of turning it off, and just knowing that it's on some kind of radio frequency at all is a good start. But you know, I am a giant fan of encryption. I like looking at encryption and seeing how it's implemented. But I cannot expect every parent out there to be an expert in encryption and an expert in security just to buy a toy for their kid.
Right.
It's fairly unreasonable to ask people to do. But that's why you have like security researchers out there looking at this stuff. Yeah. Happy to do it.
All right. We're going to take some calls now. Alex is calling from Medford. Alex, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd just like to say I'm in the middle of the fence here. I definitely see your point about, you know, bringing out child creativity with toys and, you know, make sure that the toy isn't a tool that's, you know, or is a tool that's used by the child to, you know, manipulate their creativity into the real world. And I think, you know, at the same point, there is also something that has to be done to teach people about new technologies and about how to, you know, balance them in your life. So you have to have fun without technology and with technology, you know, in the same regard that you have to learn without it and learn with it. And I think that's true with everyone, not just kids. And I don't blame toy makers for making things, you know, I think it's much more down to each individual parent.
Hmm. So would you buy these kinds of toys, Alex?
I think in, you know, the way that I'm talking about it, whereas if I was going out and having fun with my kids playing a game that was entirely imagination-based, and then I wanted to come back inside and say, all right, here's your device, plug in and shut your brain off, it's going to tell you what to do from here, I think that'd be okay. But, you know, it's much more about finding the balance.
Okay. Josh, what do you think of that? There's a balance somewhere. Is there a balance that, well, parents can easily strike here with these things?
I think there is a balance, but I think there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is that balance is different as children get older. And I think we really want to err with younger children when we're talking about preschool children and younger than school ready on the side of real world interaction, real world play, real world creativity. And then, you know, strive more towards that balance as kids get to be in school age. I really think there's no harm in delaying introduction to this stuff for kids when they're in preschool. And the other thing to think about is that it's cumulative. So if kids are already spending a lot of time watching TV and they're already spending a lot of time on a tablet or, you know, watching YouTube videos or playing video games, and then their toys are also screen-based, now we have yet another screen-based activity that kids are engaged in. And so now, you know, that it doesn't leave a lot of time for other things. And so if your internet-connected toy is replacing, you know, playing a video game, that's one thing. But if it's replacing playing outside or if it's replacing playing with blocks or Legos, that's another thing. And so I think when we're talking about balance, that's really important to keep in mind.
Okay, I want to take another call. Jeff is calling from Hancock, New Hampshire. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have to take, you know, a different point of view on early, you know, adoption of some of these toys to, like, preschoolers. I've seen my daughter pick up games like Little Big Planet and Minecraft and learn complex concepts such as combining objects to create objects, to put objects together, to build entire worlds before she could even speak. And so I have to say that there has, you know, there is some benefit to this that I think, you know, can't be ignored.
Hmm. So your daughter, as a preschooler, was able to sort of
yes.
get complex concepts from technology.
Exactly. A four-year-old who was picking up a game controller on the PS4 and building entire cities in Minecraft and combining objects, wood, and other things to make torches and combining objects to make steel and, you know, to make her castle stronger, to build moats and to protect herself from whatever, you know, demons they have on these games. But I would come into the room and see this elaborate city that she had developed, and she had characters with names, and you know, they would play out, act out roles, and play the games. They made the games theirs. You know, they were in complete control of these things.
Right, but with these internet connected toys and privacy issues regarding toys that are connected to the internet and what folks may have access to for a variety of purposes. Sometimes maybe it's just marketing, or sometimes it may be something more sinister than that. I mean, how do you kind of balance that? You see advantages to these kinds of toys, but what do you do to protect your privacy and your child's privacy?
I think there's definitely a role of the parents to know what toy that their child has exposure to. And obviously, like I know from just tablets, that there are definitely apps out there that are literally just phishing for, you know, children to use their parents' credit cards to run up these excessive bills. So you have to be savvy on your end to know what you're exposing your child to, and you don't just let them do what they want to do all on their own without any supervision.
All right, Jeff, thanks. I want to take that to Todd. Todd,
yeah.
How do parents, you know, make sure that they're up to date on these kinds of things to protect their privacy?
So there aren't a ton of internet-connected toys today, right? Like what the last caller was talking about was more along the lines of video games and apps
right.
and stuff like that. And that's totally in bounds, right, for this kind of conversation. But when it comes to the internet-connected toys, you know, what parents really can do is kind of make sure that the kid is getting trained, because that's essentially what these things are, right? Like, they're training kids on how to use technology. The thing I worry about is that kids getting trained to overshare, right? And to give up too much information, you know, because, like, my kids are kids of the internet, but they also have a security engineer who lives in the house.
Okay.
So my kids never use their real name on the internet. They always have aliases. They will, like, flip a coin to pick which gender they're going to be that day, you know? Mm. My kids are kind of ahead of that curve a little
because
bit.
You've yeah. Because you've gone through all of this.
Because my kids are wonderful and brilliant, you know, like all parents' kids are.
No, but because you've gone through right. all of this with them, and you've said this is what you need to do to be
right.
safe.
Right, exactly. And so, like, the kind of the thing that parents can do when they're dealing with these IoT toys and their kids is, like, I'm not saying you have to monitor the kid 24/7, right? Like, but if you take a look at, like, well, what are the script that Hello Barbie goes through? Like, do you have a dog? What's your favorite color? What's your social security number? Like, if that pops up in there, maybe not prime the kid to be very interested in answering all these questions, or answering all these questions truthfully. I mean, there's no problem in having aliases, right?
So I'm wondering if there are a set of questions, and say there's really disturbing information that a child confesses online somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any sort of process in place for, like, a mandated reporting, almost like a hospital if a child, or a school if someone says something? Do either of you know? Is there, or are we not even close to that yet?
It depends on the service. I know that, like, so, like, Facebook, for example, they don't make an IoT toy, but Facebook takes a lot of responsibility for the kinds of things that traverse their network.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know of anything in IoT toy land that...
Yeah, I mean, Mattel said after some pressure, they said that they would report. But, you know, it's an interesting question because there's not really a right answer there. I mean, if somebody is listening to this, and with Hello Barbie, there were actually people listening to conversations, and you hear something that's disturbing, well, you can't not act on that. But at the same time, kids make up stuff all the time
right.
As part of their imaginative play, and you want to, you know, get family services and the police involved... based on some kid's imaginative conversation. So it's really a kind of a tricky quandary, which I don't think there's a right answer to, and which to me is another reason to avoid these toys, because really, how do you answer that?
Hmm. Would there ever be a point, do you think, that you would find that some of these toys might be acceptable?
Well, I think, I think ones that aren't designed to collect information from kids. I think ones that aren't being used for marketing purposes. I mean, we didn't even really talk about that today, but the wealth of information that's being collected from toys that are asking kids questions that can then be used for marketing purposes, I think is extremely concerning.
Isn't that the bulk of what's being done here, is to gather information that can be put in some sort of algorithm so you can determine purchasing habits and then sell, right?
That's certainly part of what's going on here. Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yes. And so that's extremely concerning. And so, and part of it is, you know, the privacy policies. No parent can understand the privacy policy. They're not written clearly. They're
unless
very
you're
vague.
Todd.
Unless you're Todd, they're written very vaguely. And when you're talking about a toy, it's even more complicated, because are you going to buy that $300 Barbie dream house, and then you go and download the app for it, and you see, oh my God, this privacy policy is a nightmare, and your kid has a $300 dream house. What do you do then? Like, you're yanking that out of their hands, because now you're seeing the privacy policy, so right. It's even more complicated with the toys and the privacy policy.
All right, well, I'm sure we're going to have to revisit this again, because we are out of time now, but I want to thank both of you for being with us. Josh Golan, Executive Director of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Also, Todd Beardsley, Senior Security Research Manager at Rapid7. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Finally today, we want to take a trip to the kitchen to talk about fish. Although summer vacations are winding down and you can start to feel September in the air, there is still time to enjoy the flavors from our New England shores. Author Jennifer Traynor Thompson calls fish and shellfish superfoods that she says are easy to cook and enjoy all year long. Traynor Thompson says it's about time we get over our fear of fish and cook more of it. And she explains exactly how to do that in her latest book titled Fresh Fish, A Fearless Guide to Grilling, Shucking, Searing, Poaching, and Roasting Seafood. Traynor Thompson joins us now from the studios of WAMC in Albany. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jennifer.
Thank you.
So you've written more than 20 books. You've been nominated for 3 James Beard Awards, and you call your latest, your most personal book, and quote, a barefoot ode to the soul of the coast. What does that mean?
Well, it's ostensibly a seafood cookbook, but it really is about the pleasures of living along the coast of New England from Maine to Connecticut. And I'm a 10th generation swamp Yankee, which means I hail from southeastern Massachusetts. And it's a book I've always wanted to read. I can lose myself in the marshes and the waves and the clam flats of the coast, whether it's the rocky shore of Maine or it's, you know, in the Cape and Islands. So this was such a pleasurable romp through, you know, what makes coastal, and what does it feel like to just indulge yourself and lose yourself in the pleasures of looking out to the sea.
So we'll get to recipes in just a minute, but right now you spend your time between the Berkshires and Buzzards Bay, and you actually say that coastal New England has become more interesting in terms of its cuisine. You think so? We're not talking about just basic seafood recipes here. We're talking about some variations.
That's true. I mean, there are old standbys, you know, certainly baked beans and things, but the coast of New England is so interesting right now, obviously part of the artisanal and locavore movement, but people, there are so many people who take various flavors, whether it's from the immigrants that it started with the whalers and continued with those who worked in the textile mills. I mean, for example, in Providence, Rhode Island, you find influences of Portuguese and Azorean, Italian cooking, more recently Lebanese. In New Bedford, you've got Guatemalan and El Salvadorian flavors. It's just really interesting the rifts that people have taken with their foods, both at home and in the restaurants. And while I've always written about what interests me, my first book was actually on nuclear power, And then I went on to write about hot sauces, and my father kept saying I went from explosion to explosion. But this is a book after my own heart. It's all about gunkholing. And my publisher said, "What is gunkholing?" And I said, "The people who like the coast will know that that's just hanging out by the water and kicking up your feet and enjoying the pleasures of the salt air and the sea."
All right. Well, let's start, as any good New Englander should, with chowder, and or should I say chowda, right?
Chowda.
Chowda. Okay. So one of the recipes in your book is a recipe from President Kennedy, his chowder recipe. Tell us about that, and tell us what's different about his version compared with others.
Yeah. You know, chowders were a really interesting place to start. They were, you know, one of the original dishes that seafarers would use because it's just one pot. In fact, my parents honeymooned in Provincetown in 1952, and they camped on the beach and fished all day, and they just had a pot going on a wood fire for the whole 2 weeks that they just would add to. And that's just how forgiving it is. And as I was researching it, I found that every state and every region has its own predilections. I know that you were in Rhode Island for a while, which is a very small state with very big flavors.
Very big.
And they make a chowder with no cream or milk.
Right, it's clear, you know, clear broth, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a bacon base with a roux. It's just marvelous. But I also wanted to contribute a really basic New England clam chowder, like what you really want on a rainy night when you're in New Bedford. And JFK's chowder is, and it's hilarious, it's in the archives at the library in Boston, and apparently a young girl had written to him asking her for his recipe, and his secretary, she was disabled, and his secretary put a note on top of it and said, "Dear Mr. President, please reply to her. She'll be extremely happy. And do not mention anything in the letter about her handicap, please." as so he would. But anyway, the response was he sent this young girl his recipe. And it's very traditional. I mean, it's actually a fish chowder instead of a clam chowder, although you could certainly suggest substitute clams. Mm. And it's rendered with a salt pork, and it's got haddock and onions and potato and celery. And it's very simply seasoned with bay leaf, salt, and pepper. And it's milk instead of cream and a little bit of butter. And it's delicious.
Mm. Well, you know, a lot of this, you said, is to help people get over their fear of fish. So let's talk just briefly, because we want to give some bullet points here to people about some of the reasons why people might be afraid of fish. First of all, how do you buy it? How do you know it's any good? I remember a saying in my house was, if it smells like fish, it's probably old. If it smells like the ocean, it's probably gold. Is that a rule?
Oh, that's a great one. I've never heard that.
Yeah.
I mean, and the adage I know is fish and company stink after 3 days.
Right, right.
It was really interesting. Being a New Englander, I assumed everybody cooked fish as much as I did. And I found so many people who told me they never cook it at home. They order salmon or shrimp in a restaurant, and that's it, because they're afraid of stinking up their kitchen and they're afraid of sourcing it. And I think it's the eyes. You know, when you buy beef, you just aren't confronted with eyes, right, of the cow. So yes, you want to look for, if there are eyes, you want to look for eyes that are really clear. You want to look for a fish that has absolutely no smell. And then if you press on the fish, that it sort of bounces back. You know, you can tell if it's really, really fresh. And that's what you're looking for. I think you also want to trust your source. You want to go to a market that you think is really good. And I had a fascinating trip. The fishmonger I go to, I asked him to take me to the market, and he took me at 5:30 a.m. to New Bedford, and I learned so much. For example, when the trawlers go out, they go out for a week. And so when they bring back fresh fish, some of it is 7 days old and some of it is 1 day old. And I asked this fishmonger how he always got the fish that was 1 day old. And he said, "Well, the buddy who works on the boat I went to high school with." And that's how it works. You know, these trawlers are, they're cousins or high school buddies who work together. And so I think that if you that's the first stop, is to trust who you're buying it from.
Hmm. Now, it is the end of August, so I'm wondering, give us one recommendation for an end of summer recipe right now with a fish that's in its prime this time of year.
Oh, gosh, there's so much. Let's see. Well, bluefish, certainly. I mean, the blues are running. And if you're lucky to catch one, you know, you can just clean it and keep the head and tail intact. And it is the simplest thing. You put in the cavity lemon, limes, salt and pepper, a little bit of olive oil. You could add herbs if you wanted to. You could add basil, thyme, whatever you have in your garden that you find flavorful. You line the cavity with the lemon and lime slices and season it generously. And then you coat the outsides of the fish with a little bit of oil. And then you grill it, generally 10 minutes per inch of thickness of fish. And you flip it halfway through.
All right. Sounds delicious. Jennifer Traynor Thompson, author of more than 20 books, including her latest titled Fresh Fish, A Fearless Guide to Grilling, Shucking, Searing, Poaching, and Roasting Seafood. Jennifer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You can find more information, including recipes for Rhode Island clam chowder and stuffies, at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.